All right, everybody, welcome and good afternoon. Today we have my brother, Father Andrew Hart, coming in from Holy Redeemer in Clarksville, who's here to talk to us all about annulments, the how, what, and why. So without further ado, welcome Father Andrew.
Thanks, everybody. Good to be with you. Let's maybe start with a little prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this chance to gather on the day when we celebrate the love and new life that your Son gives to us by his resurrection. We ask you to help us to hear your word today, to may it speak to our hearts, speak to the realities of our lives, and may through the church's ministry in this area, may we find healing for ourselves and all who need it. We ask your blessing upon us as we gather today through Christ our Lord. Amen. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. There's a handout here on the table for anybody who's coming in, and I hope it doesn't scare you that I tried to type up a few outline of notes that I think would at least help kind of show you where we're at in the presentation. Want to thank everybody for coming out. This topic may not be, I don't know, the most enthusiastic and interesting one that some of the Theology on Tap talks are. I don't know, but it's probably more relevant in some ways to some of your lives. And I want to say first that I know people maybe are coming out for different reasons. Maybe some of you are here purely because you just want to know more about this area, you have kind of academic interest. For others of you, you might have family members or friends that this is relevant to. Maybe you yourself have gone through or are going through, contemplating going through some kind of marriage nullity process. So I want to just acknowledge that at the beginning. Some of the ways that we might talk about that, or I might talk about some of these realities, could be fairly direct or frank. Just know in advance that I'm kind of, I don't want the way I speak about some of these things to come across, you know, insensitively or unpastorally. There's certainly important conversations that should be had and need to be had at a one-to-one level that maybe when we talk about these things kind of theoretically in a context like this, we can't get into all of those qualifiers and different things. So just a little bit maybe of a trying to trigger warning if this is somehow particularly relevant to you or somebody you know and love, that we could be talking about these things kind of frankly, and I don't want that to be taken in a sense that we don't care about your particular life or circumstances. I would also say that I think if you do want to talk about this further, need to go have a conversation with somebody, I certainly would encourage you to do that in your parish. I know Father Stephen, I can speak for him, would be glad to sit with you, talk with you, hear your story, etc. I'd be happy to do myself in Clarksville if you're willing to make the drive over. And people, too, who work in our tribunal office, which used to include me, I'm no longer there in the office each day. But I know they're also accustomed to having conversations with people, hearing their stories, trying to be caring and concerning. And so that's, you know, something that you might want to avail yourself of as well. We can speak more about some of these things in the Q&A if you'd like. Is it on?
It's there. It's okay. It should be on.
Everybody hear me okay? Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay. Okay, so just to get started, because we kind of have a lot to, you know, go through, and I also want to make sure we leave some time for Q&A. We can't really talk about annulments, per se, or marriage nullity until we talk about marriage, because it's kind of like when you're, it's not a perfect analogy, but if you take your car into the shop and it's not working correctly, you have to know how it's supposed to work first in order to diagnose kind of what's gone wrong with it. So kind of in a similar way, before we can kind of talk about how a marriage either never came about in the first place or did come about validly but broke down for other reasons, we have to kind of look at the ideal of marriage and what the church teaches about marriage first. So we have here a definition of marriage in Canon 1055 of the Code of Canon Law, that marriage is a covenant by which a man and a woman establish between themselves a partnership of the whole of life, and which is ordered by its nature to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. So just to take those pieces by part, that definition in pieces, a covenant. So we're talking about a spiritual agreement, a spiritual contract that's entered into freely. This is a legal juridic idea. although it certainly has something more than that. It's something that is spiritual. It involves the whole of life, so not just one particular aspect of one's life. It's a real sharing and joining together of the whole of the person. Jesus speaks of it in the Gospels as becoming one flesh, two people becoming one flesh. It is by which a man and a woman, that is one man and one woman. We certainly are aware of how both the number and the sex of the contractants of marriage is something that's being changed in a cultural context in our society today. But the church sees it as exclusive between one man and one woman. It's not possible, for example, to have a marriage between one man and multiple women, or between you know, two women, two men, etc. That's not a spiritual reality that's even possible. Established between themselves. So this is not something that can be inflicted upon someone by force. It has to be free. A marriage that comes around about by physical force, a literally shotgun wedding, or a marriage that happens by threat, is invalid. That's one of the grounds of marriage nullity. It's also something in which, at least according to the Latin Catholic theology of it, the ministers of the marriage, the sacrament of marriage, are themselves the couple, the two contractants, the man and the woman. They are the ones who are exchanging the consent and who are conferring the marriage upon themselves. The church's minister, the priest or the deacon that's there, is receiving the consent on behalf of the church. But he's not the minister of the sacrament in the same way he is in, say, confession or the Eucharist or anointing of the sick. Slightly different in Eastern Catholic theology, but we can talk about that more in the Q&A. Again, I mentioned it's a partnership of the whole of life. So it's not just to kind of, you know, share fertility. Marriage is not just about, you know, having as many babies as possible. It's not just to become sexual partners. It's not just for inheritance sake. It's the whole of life, all of the things that make up life. And then we see the two ends of marriage, that it's ordered by its nature to the good of spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. So those are the two, what we call fines operis, the two ends of the actual work. The first of them is the mutual support of spouses. This is was traditionally always seen as the secondary end of marriage. But in the new Code of Canon Law that was published in 1983, it's now listed first in the canon. The second end that's mentioned here is procreation, education of children. So we have not just the generation of children, but also their education. And we mean especially here, education in the faith, becoming part of the church. So this has always been understood as the primary purpose of marriage. And it's the one that gives a grounding to that other purpose. So marriage is for children. You might have heard that said before by your parents or grandparents. Especially prior to Vatican II, that was seen as the principal end of marriage. And the secondary end, the spousal support, is in order to accomplish the first end. So in order to have children, in order for the human race to grow and multiply as God commands human beings to do in the book of Genesis, it needs a foundation, and the foundation for children, for them to be raised well, is the lifelong union between a man and a woman. So spouses are intended and called and given the ability to mutually support and help each other in order to raise a family. That's the traditional understanding of the church. We've kind of shifted the emphasis a little bit of that, I think, in our, not just in the church after the council, but to some degree, certainly in the broader society and culture. You know, when people come to a priest to get married, they're often not necessarily thinking immediately about having babies, right? They're thinking about that they love each other, that they want to enter into a stable union, that they want to pursue certain common goals and dreams. And sometimes we as priests have to remind them, okay, but are you planning to have children? Because if you're not, if you are excluding that from your will, then that's a problem. We'll see that again as one of the grounds of nullity. So we see, as I said, the two ends of marriage, the mutual support of spouses and the procreation education of children. Along with those two ends, there's two essential properties of marriage, and that is that it has kind of certain defining traits. If these traits were to be changed, or if someone wants marriage without these traits, then you don't have a real marriage. And the first of these is unity, so that the two spouses, as I said, are in exclusive union, and that's with each other. You can't be married to one person while you can't marry one person with if you're already married to somebody else. It's not a spiritually possible thing to do. So a man and a woman joined in marriage are united in an exclusive way. And then this implies, of course, that they're called to be faithful to each other. So fidelity is a good of marriage that flows from this property of unity. The second property of marriage is indissolubility, or sometimes called permanence, that marriage by its nature is lifelong and that it comes to an end with the death of one of the parties. We can speak of indissolubility in two senses. One is intrinsic, that is that those who are in the marriage don't have the ability to break the marriage once it's begun, that if it's a true, valid marriage, then it's lifelong and they can't themselves end that contract. You know, if we have a leak at the roof in my church, and we're trying to get different roofers to come out and give us bids on it. And if I were to hire one of them and he's not doing a great job, I can break the contract and go find somebody else. You can't do the same thing with the contract of marriage, right? It's kind of unique in that way. So it's intrinsically indissoluble for the two people who are in the marriage. Extrinsically, that means from without, there are a couple rare circumstances, and if we have time, we'll get into them, in which it can be dissolved. One is in the case of two unbaptized persons, that a new marriage can itself dissolve the old one if there is basically one of the persons wants to get married, become baptized and get married in the church, then for the sake of the new marriage in the Christian context, St. Paul writes to the Corinthians about how the new marriage itself dissolves the old one. The other one is there's two other circumstances in which the Pope can dissolve a marriage, but it's very, very rare, very unique circumstances. Just to kind of continue on, marriage, I talk here about marriage being singular. You know, we talk about in kind of common parlance in different ways about being married. We might say, oh, you know, so-and-so got married in the church. You know, we might say somebody's only married civilly. It's helpful, I think, for kind of discussing our human circumstances and realities. But marriage in reality doesn't have different forms or different stages or different sources. There is just marriage. And so it's either a valid bond, what we call a valid marital bond, or it's nothing at all. So the whole purpose of what we'll get into eventually when we start talking about marriage nullity is detecting, discerning whether there was a valid bond from the beginning of the marriage or not, even if all exterior appearances were, they got married in the cathedral in front of the bishop and all kinds of big things. Maybe there was still some flaw that prevented a true bond from forming from the beginning. So does that mean that we only recognize marriages that happen in the church? No, because we tend to think of marriage maybe in the terms of its, you know, church context. The sacrament of matrimony is one of the seven sacraments. But marriage is unique among the sacraments in that the reality that we're working with here predates Jesus's birth on earth, right? So marriage is something that goes all the way back to God's formation of human beings. And Jesus himself refers to this in Matthew's gospel. He answered them, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." So Jesus is referring to the fact that marriage is in some way part of our human reality. It's part of the way in which God has ordered our nature. And so as an institution, it's not just something of the church. It's also something natural. And so when we refer to marriage, we recognize that it's possible for not just two Catholics to marry, but it's possible for two Jews to marry or two Muslims or two Buddhists and to be in a real, true, valid marriage. Sometimes people have the concept that the church only recognizes Catholic marriages. That's not true. That sometimes comes around because we know that Catholics can't be in a true marriage unless you get married in the church or unless you receive a dispensation from canonical form. That's only true for Catholics. It's not true for non-Catholics or especially even non-Christians. So it's important to recognize that marriage can exist outside of being a Catholic thing, outside of being even a sacramental thing. Two Jewish people are in a valid marriage, presumably valid marriage, even though it's not a sacrament for them because they're not baptized. So Christ, we would say, raised the institution of marriage to the dignity of being a sacrament so that for those who are baptized, it becomes a way of growing in holiness, growing in love for the Lord and experiencing his love. It also becomes a means by which two people witness the love of Christ, especially in sacrificial form, like the love of the church for Christ, for his church. St. Paul talks about this in the letter to the Ephesians. But it's not. It's also possible for marriage to be true, valid, loving, lifelong, etc., even if it's not a Christian reality. So how does marriage come about? There's kind of been different ways of thinking about that question according to societies throughout history. For example, in the Germanic context, for those of you who are also of the German stock like myself, Germanic societies typically saw marriage as coming about only after consummation. And it was important for the father to hand over the daughter to be married, often through kind of tribal arrangements, etc. But the marriage really didn't come about and be recognized until consummation. But in Roman society, and including also in Jewish society, it's not consummation that makes marriage, but it's consent. And so it's the act of the will of the two persons by which they give and accept themselves, give themselves and then accept the other, that forms this covenant, this irrevocable covenant that establishes marriage. This is important. It became an important debate in the Middle Ages because those who wanted to say, well, no, it has to be consummation that makes marriage kind of a final thing. The church father said, well, you know, that's a problem for wanting to say that Mary and Joseph were truly wedded to each other, right? Because we know that they didn't consummate their marriage, right? But they were truly married, right? And we see how that's played out in the Gospel of Luke, you know, that St. Joseph decides to accept Mary into his home, even though he knows that she is pregnant with the Lord, right? Giving and accepting each other is the language, as I said, that is used in canon law. It used to be that this was referred to in a more kind of concrete sense of giving and accepting what's called the jus ad corpus. Now, this gets into kind of some tricky theological territory. I'll leave it for Father Stephen to talk about this the next time. But this is the right to the body, right? So if you've read the letters of St. Paul, you know that he talks about marriage being also a cure for concupiscence, and that while he says it's better to remain unmarried, if one is experiencing sexual desire, it's better to marry and then have that to be an aid to not falling into sexual impurity. And you have a kind of jus ad corpus, a certain right to the body of the other person. It has to be done, obviously, in a loving, respectful, human way, not, you know, forcefully, et cetera, et cetera. But there is this sense, especially in the old code, the 1917 code, in which this was understood as what was happening in marriage. You were giving yourself the right to your body to the other person. They were giving their right to your body to you. And in that way, you were exchanging the rights needed in order to procreate, in order to start a family. Okay, turn my page here. We'll try to save our questions for the end, just because we have a lot of territory to go through. But I hope I'm not going too quickly. The last thing to say about kind of marriage is that it enjoys the favor of law. So if you think about this in kind of a logical way, if we doubted that, you know, if you had to prove that your marriage was valid and you didn't, you know, presume to be married until you had done so, we wouldn't really have a basic way of living out a society, right? We have, if you're getting married, then you'd presume that you're marrying validly, that marriage is a valid reality, and that it's only if it's shown to not be valid that presumption is overturned, right? So this is the basic principle that the church uses, that is that, you know, if two people enter into marriage and observe the different ways in which that marriage has to come about, then it's presumed that that is a true valid marriage, until and unless it's been shown not to be. And so that's the whole purpose, as I said, of the marriage nullity process, is to see if that question it can be answered and answered in a satisfactory way to then be a judgment be given about it. So moving then to the second kind of section here on marriage nullity, kind of the theory side of it a little bit. I think it's important first to say that there we have a language issue here. We talk about annulments, you know, got to get my annulment, etc. And we tend to think of it in that way, oftentimes, maybe like people who have to apply for a driver's license or a bank loan. Like if I'm going to the bank and I need to get a loan, I'm showing them that I'm a good, upstanding person. You know, I'm going to pay my money back. You know, please, you know, accept me for that and give me this thing that I'm looking for. Unfortunately, that's not the way that we actually are. That's not at all what we're doing in the marriage nullity process. It's much more like somebody who has to go through a genetic test of some kind, right, to discover if they have some inclination toward a disease. Their own feeling about it may be one thing, but what the reality is something else. So it's not as if the church is granting annulments in order to, you know, you've convinced me, you've shown me that your story is sympathetic and that you are a good person, etc., that your former spouse really mistreated you, etc., etc. We can, again, kind of show pastoral concern and solicitude for that story, but it doesn't necessarily change the fact of what happened at the time of consent, at the beginning of the wedding, beginning of the marriage. At the same time, we can also say that these two people, you know, are really both kind of messed up people. One of them is, you know, really a rotten person. You know, we don't really necessarily want to, you know, assist them in maybe going on to, you know, mess up somebody else's life down the road. At the same time, we have to say that there was no valid marriage there because of X, Y, and Z. So it's hard to kind of maybe get our minds around that a little bit, but try to think of it in that way, that we're trying to detect and discern something that is the objective reality apart and aside from our own subjective experience of it. Oftentimes people come to the tribunal in the marriage nullity process shortly after going through the civil divorce process. And so it certainly can be very painful. They can have a lot of, often rightfully so, animosity toward their previous spouse, etc. Even the way I'm referring to it right there, the previous spouse, your ex-spouse, you know, we're kind of just used to speaking about these things in that way. But that's not the way we're operating it in terms of the church's judicial processes. Again, marriage is presumed to be valid until it's shown not to be. So it's really not proper then to speak about an annulment, because what's happening is not the church saying, okay, I'm now taking this thing that exists and I'm making it go away. I'm, you know, dissolving it, etc. As I said, there's only a couple of very rare circumstances in which we can talk about marriage dissolution. But what's actually happening is the church is declaring that nullity was present from the beginning, that what was seen and thought to be a true and valid marriage never actually came around. And so the marriage is invalid. It's not ever been in existence. Again, we can't make that kind of judgment until it's been shown to be the case and proven with moral certitude. So basically, that's equivalent in the church's jurisprudence not quite absolute certainty. I mean, only God can know for sure the spiritual state of our souls, right, and whether any given marriage is truly valid or not valid. But basically, any reasonable doubt has been removed that the marriage is invalid. So that's the kind of level of certainty that we're trying to strive for, more than just kind of probably invalid or very likely invalid, kind of beyond reasonable doubt is what we're aiming for. Again, it makes sense, because if we kind of were to question any marriage, you know, without that level, then kind of society itself kind of begins to erode away. Okay, let's talk about three general causes of invalidity. I'll have to kind of go through these quickly just in the interest of time, but there's three things that pertain to marriage in terms of how an invalid marriage could come about. The first is an impediment. This is a legal disqualification that prevents the person from being able to be married. So typically these things are asked about and then weeded out, so to speak, before a person gets to being married, certainly at least through the Christian Catholic context. But very occasionally it can also happen that it remains undiscovered until after the marriage. So just to go through these quickly, age. In the church's law, a woman under the age of 14 and a man under the age of 16 cannot validly marry. In our country as well, you need permission from your parents if you're under the age of 18. If neither party's Catholic, then the civil law determines that minimum age for a valid marriage. But, you know, a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old who, you know, stand up and say, I marry you, you marry me, etc., I do. Everybody would agree they're not actually marrying, right? That's ridiculous. They're under the age in which it's possible to do that. You might ask why 14 and 16? Because these are the presumed ages of puberty. And it's been the church's teaching that once a person has reached the age of physical puberty, at least, they are capable of marriage in a human way. Now, obviously, we know psychology today is much different than it was maybe even 100 years ago. So there's a lot of people who wonder if we need to change these ages. But at least in a kind of minimally valid sense, and again, we're not just talking about the United States of America here, but we might be talking about other societies in which people do wed and begin having families at a much younger age. In a minimally valid sense, 14 and 16 are the ages we're talking about here. Another impediment would be impotence, the inability to have the sexual act, the conjugal act. This has to be perpetual, so it's unable to be remedied by, say, medicine. And it also has to be antecedent to the marriage. So somebody who becomes impotent years after the marriage, that doesn't make the marriage not happen. But a person who's permanently medically incapable of performing the sexual act is not able to validly marry. This is not the same thing as infertility, right? So if a person's able to copulate, then that can be still a valid marriage, even if there's one or both is infertile, sterile, etc. This can happen for physically medical reasons. It often more commonly happens, and again, this is very rare, but more often happens for psychological reasons. So there's some people who psychologically are very traumatized and unable to engage in the conjugal act. Another one, this is the most common impediment that we run across in tribunal contexts, is a prior marriage. If you married somebody else before, and that marriage is presumed to be valid, you're not able to marry the person that you maybe are thinking you're now married to or wish to marry, right? And so we encounter this a lot sometimes for people who are not Catholic, who maybe want to become Catholic or they wish to marry a Catholic, but they have themselves several prior marriages because, as we know, not everybody has the same view of marriage and divorce, etc., as do Catholics, not at least not anymore. It used to be that they did, but they've kind of gone away from that. So it's often the case that this particular area of prior marriage, an impediment to prior marriage, is looked at in that context. Okay, well, can we say there was, if Joe's married to Susie, but Susie had been before married to Bill, you know, then Joe and Susie can't get married. But maybe Bill himself had been previously married to somebody else, and they're no longer part of the equation. Bill, we know, was married to Annie. Well, okay, well, then Bill and Annie's marriage is presumed to be valid, so therefore he wasn't able to marry Susie, so therefore Joe and Susie can get married, right? It gets very complicated if you're looking at 5, 6, 7 marriages, which often happens. Another one is disparity of worship. So the church views that a Catholic cannot validly marry a person who is not baptized unless that impediment is dispensed. The bishop has the ability to dispense that for good reason. The reason for this historically is that there was always a fear that Catholics would lose their faith, lose their Christian faith even, by marrying a non-baptized person. So it was seen as something very exceptional. Even today, it's kind of not something to be taken completely lightly, although there's certainly many happy marriages between a Catholic and an unbaptized person. But without that dispensation, it's not, it's an impediment. Another one applies to Father Stephen and myself, sacred orders or being in a religious vow. If I were to go to the Justice of the Peace tomorrow, or even was able to convince a priest to marry me to somebody in a church, that would be an invalid marriage because I'm bound by the impediment of sacred orders, right? I do not have the ability to marry someone, an ability I would have had before I was ordained, right? Say Father Stephen. Another one is abduction. A man cannot validly marry a woman whom he has kidnapped with the intention of marrying her. You might think this is esoteric, but it does come up in certain contexts, in certain cultures, in which that was seen as a legitimate way of obtaining a wife. The woman can elect, after she has been separated from the man, to return, but it has to be a free act that she makes, and can't do that until that separation has occurred. Another impediment is what's called the impediment of crime. This is a person who brings about the death of his or her own spouse in order, or somebody else's spouse, to marry in order to get married. So if that happens, we've seen lots of movies where these kinds of things happen. Those persons cannot validly marry because of the impediment that comes about. The last one is consanguinity, affinity, public propriety, and adoption. Just to briefly say, there are certain relationships in which we are too close to each other, or persons can be too close to each other because of blood or because of marriage, and it's seen as basically contra public propriety for a marriage to happen, not possible. So, it's against divine law for a person to marry their parent. Right, or their grandparent. It's against church law for them to marry their first cousin. It can be dispensed. That particular relationship can be dispensed. It has happened historically, especially in royal contexts. But to marry, for example, your aunt or your uncle or your niece or your nephew is invalid, not possible. It's also not possible if you've been married to a man has been married to a woman, say the woman dies, he cannot then marry her mother or her daughter, right? Because he was has an affinity, a spiritual relationship that came about because of the marriage to the woman who has passed away. And so again, it's seen as just kind of, not right, not proper. You also can't marry somebody who is, your adopted son or daughter. Adoption is seen in the church context as being the same as blood relatives. So, you might be an adopted sibling. You still can't marry your adopted brother or sister, etc. Okay, so that's the first area is impediments. The second one is defects of form. So this is only pertaining to Catholics. Only Catholics have basically a set form by which they have to marry. And the reason for this goes back to the time of the Reformation, the Council of Trent instituted that for validity, Catholics have to marry in front of a priest or deacon and with two additional witnesses, because basically there was too many people were going around and exchanging natural consent. The man said, I take you as my wife. The woman says, I take you as my husband. They do it privately, in the context of a home or out in the forest, etc. Often take on times in order to then be able to engage in, conjugal relationship. And then later, one or both of them would deny it and say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I never married you. And so there was too much scandal of that going on. Too many women left with, children to care for and a husband that's no longer around. So the church said, okay, enough of this. Catholics have to get married according to canonical form. That's before a priest or deacon with two additional witnesses who can verify that this marriage did happen if it's ever called into question. The church will grant a dispensation from this requirement of canonical form if there's a good reason to do so. So if a man is marrying a woman who's the daughter of a Protestant minister or a rabbi or something like that, then it's very, very commonly the case that dispensation is given so that she can marry before her father or her somebody like that. Even sometimes before a civil official, there might be a good reason. The church is usually willing to work with people on those kinds of things. But if that form is not observed, then even two people who otherwise are free to marry, and they go to the Justice of the Peace or they go to the Protestant minister down the road, and they try to exchange consent. If one of them is Catholic and they haven't obtained that at dispensation, then we have a lack of canonical form, and that's not a true marriage. So we're all familiar with people who got married, quote unquote, outside the church, and then that marriage, that so-called marriage came to an end, and then they find somebody else, and they are able to kind of go through a relatively short, quote unquote, annulment case, because all we have to do is basically show one of them was baptized or later became Catholic, and that this marriage happened without any kind of dispensation from the church, and therefore it's just a recognition and acknowledgement there was no marriage there. Now, that's not to say necessarily that they didn't create, you know, or cause some kind of, moral, do something morally wrong, perhaps by treating the other person poorly or abandoning them, et cetera, but at least that's the juridic reality, is that there was never a true marriage there because of that requirement of canonical form. The other one's a little more rare, and this is defective form. So there's certain requirements that the church also makes, especially for the minister. So, for example, a pastor of a parish has the right to witness marriages in his own parish, but not outside of that without permission from the bishop. And so in our diocese, any priest can witness a marriage in any parish. But in other dioceses, not always the case. If you have some, Father Jim jets in from some other place and witnesses the marriage and jets back out, and he never got permission from the bishop, that's a defective form, that you don't have a minister who's capable of receiving the consent on behalf of the church. So those things sometimes get caught. And then either if that marriage is still happening, is still going on, people are still happy, etc., then that can get fixed. If it's not, then it sometimes is a kind of get out of jail free card for that marriage. Sometimes you see this with a couple who is, one party is Catholic, the other one's not Catholic. And, 30, 40 years ago was commonly seen, oh, let's have the Protestant minister and the Catholic minister kind of share duties, and he'll do this and the other person will do that. And well, from the church's point of view, that's a problem, because there's certain things that have to be done by the receiving minister, namely the asking of the questions and the witnessing, the reception of the vows. Can't split those things up and then say that form was followed through with. So the marriage would be declared invalid for that reason. Just slight kind of, this basically only, again, applies to Catholics, although if you know somebody or if you've heard of somebody who's Orthodox or a member of another Eastern church, they would insist upon a priest being the minister who blesses the marriage. And so sometimes a Catholic can marry an Orthodox person who had maybe not been married by a priest before, just had a civil marriage. So the Orthodox churches are kind of their own unique thing. Okay, the third and most common area of marriage nullity, or the reason for marriage nullity, is what we call defective consent. So this is something, we talked about defective form, the actual kind of going through with the marriage, something went astray, they didn't get permission to get married outside the church, etc. We talked about legal disqualifications that prevent that consent from coming about. But this is something that's problematic in the actual consent that's being exchanged. And this can happen either unknown to the parties or known to them. So we'll talk about both of these. And again, I kind of go through these quickly. The first three are the psychological grounds. The first one is what we call lack of sufficient use of reason. This is somebody who has such severe disability or mental incapacity, either permanently or in a transitory way, that they are not able to even function in a rational sense. So there are certain, as we know, certain levels of medical disability that a person just is got maybe the age or the mental capacity of an 8-year-old or something. That person is not able to validly marry. If someone has taken drugs or has become intoxicated and is at the point they literally can't put two thoughts together, then they're at least at that moment not able to use reason in a sufficiently validly way to marry. So that's fairly rare. It's usually not common that's because if it's a Catholic context, then the person is usually exhibiting signs of being disabled in that sense, and so therefore they would not have moved forward with the wedding at that time. The second one, this is the most common ground that we have. It's called a grave defect of discretion of judgment regarding the essential matrimonial rights and obligations. So you have to be able to reason in a sufficiently minimally valid way. You then also have to be able to critically evaluate what you are doing, which is making an act of the will to marry. And there can be circumstances in which that use of judgment, discretion of judgment, the critical faculty of our minds can be inhibited, at least in regard to marriage. So this often can come about because of grave immaturity. It can come about through severe history of abuse or trauma. It can come about because of some what we call psychic anomaly. Somebody has got some, anomaly of their psychic makeup that prevents them from being able to understand and then assent to what marriage is. It can come about through things like extreme youth, pressure. It can come about through something like pregnancy can cause a kind of short-circuiting of the normal discretion of judgment that's usually needed for marriage. That's not to say that somebody who is pregnant can't marry validly, but there's got to be a lot of caution around something like that, because it's often the case that somebody might just think, well, I'm pregnant, therefore I have to get married, and we would say that's not the case. So that's the second most, and that's the most common ground we have. The second most common ground is the next one, and that is the incapacity to assume the essential obligations of marriage. So you have to have a sufficient use of reason. You have to be able to critically evaluate the good of marriage that you're about to choose and have that evaluation be at least kind of somewhat normally functioning. Then you have to be able to actually carry out the obligations that you're choosing. And so it can also happen, again, for somebody who is has got some psychological anomaly or perhaps some malady, mental illness, somehow addiction, inclination to other sexual proclivities, etc., that it's not possible for that person to live out the marital relationship that they're assenting to. And so they may not know that at the time, but they may discover that later. Maybe they do know that at the time, but it's not possible for that person to carry out that which they're assuming to live that capably. So again, you'd have a ground for nullity there. So those three psychological grounds, especially the second and the third one, are the most common grounds that tribunals today, at least in the United States, deal with. Going through the other ones quickly, ignorance. This is very rare, but it's ignorance of what we talked about marriage being at the beginning, a covenant by which a man and a woman establish a partnership of the whole of life, especially as a part of order to procreation. So very rarely you'll find there is somebody who comes from a very, very sheltered background and is ignorant of the fact that marriage involves sexual cooperation, and they discover that on their wedding night or something, and that person is invalidly married because of ignorance. They just didn't have any understanding what marriage is in that regard. Error, this is where you think you know something, but it turns out you don't know. You can be error of person. That is, you think you're marrying Jill, and you're actually marrying Jill's sister. This happens in the Bible, right, with Jacob. That's an invalid marriage, we would say. This did happen occasionally in the Middle Ages when, kings and queens would try to get, one child married off to somebody else and do it in a duplicitous way, especially because they often would not meet in person until there's time to get married. So if you think you're marrying X person and that is not the person that is actually there, that's an invalid marriage. Error concerning a quality of person. This is, you think you're marrying somebody with a particular trait, a particular quality. That is not invalid unless that quality is principally intended. So you think you're marrying somebody who is a doctor, and you find out later that they're a fraud. They're not actually a doctor, right? Well, it's not an invalidating error that you have unless you really, really wanted, above all other things, to marry a doctor. And if you'd found out that that person was not a doctor, then you would never have gone through with it. So you actually desire the quality more than the person who has the quality. That's what has to be shown in that particular ground. You also have what's called imposed error or fraud. So this is when one person deceives the other person about something regarding themselves or their own history in order to elicit marriage, right? So, yeah, we don't have to maybe go down that road. We can all think of an example maybe of where somebody deceives their intended spouse and because they know that if they find out about this thing, they would never go through with the marriage. So that has to be, again, shown that they did it for the purpose of eliciting consent to marry. And then finally, error about marriage itself. This is basically that you think you know what marriage is, but you actually don't know, especially in these areas of its essential properties. So marriage is unity, marriage has indissolubility, and marriage has a sacramental dignity. Now, this is a little tricky because sometimes we might think, well, you know, so-and-so didn't really believe in marriage that's lifelong, and therefore, you know, I should have ability to be free of that marriage. Well, it has to be shown that that error was so deeply ingrained that they cannot conceive of marriage in any other way. It's not just that they didn't really want to live out marriage that's lifelong or that they abused that idea. It's that they were just so fundamentally mistaken about marriage that they couldn't conceive of it another way. So it's kind of a high bar that has to be shown for that particular ground. Those are all examples of in which persons, at least except for the last one, imposed error, in which persons are not aware of the fact that they might be consenting invalidly. The last one in which people are definitely aware of it is simulation. And this is when somebody basically is trying to go through the external form of marriage, but for completely other reasons. They're not actually desiring marriage. That's what's called total simulation. Maybe somebody is trying to get, you know, immigration status fixed, and therefore they found a friend who's willing to marry them, but neither of them has any intention of actually living out the marriage. That's what we call total simulation. Or it's called partial simulation, and this is what you want marriage, but you want it on your terms, and you don't want it with one of these traits that is essential. So either you don't want it in such a way that you are agreeing to be faithful to your intended spouse, you're reserving to yourself the right to cheat at the time of the marriage, not down the road, but at the time of the marriage. You are reserving to your right to yourself the right to end the marriage if you think it's not going to work out. Now, this one is becoming more common in some ways because we live in a culture where obviously we're familiar with the fact that people are often divorced and remarried, etc. So sometimes people do have this kind of partial simulation against the good of permanence. And that at the time of the wedding, they're standing up there, they're saying the words, "I do," but in the back of their mind saying, "I'm going to get out of this if I have to, you know, I will decide on what grounds and on what timing I decide I need to do that." And then even simulation against the good of spouses. So this is if you're not really marrying somebody with goodwill, you're actually marrying them to create a really, you know, difficult, devastating circumstance. So the classic example of this is if the son of a mob boss marries the daughter of the rival mob boss, not because he really loves her, but because he wants to make her life hell to get back at her father, etc. Right? So that's an invalid marriage. Two last ones are conditioned consent. This is if you're saying, "I marry you if such and such is true." It can be either a such and such that's of the past, such and such that's of the present, or such and such that's of the future. The church would say, any such and such that pertains to the future, "I marry you if you will do this, and if you will not do this, then I am not marrying you." That's invalid. If it's of the past or it's of the present, the marriage is valid if the such and such is actually the case. So we can talk about more of that more in the Q&A, but that's what's called conditioned consent. The last one is force or fear. This is when a person experiences either physical force, they're physically being forced to marry somebody contrary to their own will, or grave fear that has been inflicted upon them. They have been threatened, not necessarily threatened, I should say. They either have been threatened or they've experienced, perhaps unintentionally from somebody, such grave fear that they have a threat to their own life or livelihood, in which the only way out of that is to go through with the marriage. And they can't conceive of it, of getting out of that fear in any other way. So that kind of fear is rising to the level of invalidity. Okay. All right, I'm already going longer than I intended to go. So let me just go quickly through this marriage nullity process. So again, we're talking about a judicial process. This is because marriage is a legal reality. It's a juridic reality. It changes the nature of the person's status in terms of their church standing. So in order for that marriage to not be to be declared invalid, we have to go through a judicial process, and that is a trial. So who is on the trial in a marriage nullity process? The marriage. The marriage is the one on the stand, right? It's being questioned whether or not it exists. It's not about whether that was a happy union, whether it was wise for the spouses to go through with the marriage, whether one of them mistreated the other one, you know, down the road after the wedding. Again, that may seem very important. And in a human way, in a pastoral way, it is very important. But in terms of the juridic question we're looking at, in terms of whether there's a valid marriage, we're looking at the time of consent and what was happening at the time of consent. Who is accusing the marriage that's on trial? One of the parties or both of them? The one who's accusing it's called the petitioner. They're saying my marriage was invalid for X, Y, and Z reason. The respondent is the other party. They may or may not agree with that assessment. They have an equal standing, and the court wants to hear from them. The only other person that can accuse a marriage of being invalid is a role that's called the promoter of justice, and that basically, in practice, doesn't really happen. Who is defending the marriage? Possibly the respondent, if he or she thinks my marriage was valid, and you know, my ex-spouse is saying things that are not true or only giving half the picture, etc. At least the defender of the bond. So it used to be the case that there wasn't somebody who was automatically entrusted with defending that there was a true valid marriage here. But over the centuries, the church instituted this role that every marriage case, at least every judicial process, has somebody who's been appointed to defend the bond of marriage. And then who decides? We have either the judge or the judges. Typically, marriage cases are decided by a three-judge panel, and they kind of operate as a college. At least one of them has to be a cleric, as a priest or a deacon. For exceptional circumstances, it can be the case that a marriage case can be heard by a sole judge who has to be a cleric, a priest, or a deacon. The reasons for that are kind of too complicated to go into at the moment, but I can mention in the Q&A if you'd like to. So some various processes. Again, the lack of form. You know, Catholic gets married, quote unquote, outside the church. It's shown that he or she was baptized as a Catholic. They didn't get dispensation from canonical form. That's really not even a judicial process. It's just a matter of getting the paperwork in order, and then the church issues a decree of freedom to marry. But that's, you know, we often refer to that quote as a quote unquote annulment. A documentary process, that's when you basically are disproving something by virtue of what's shown on documents. So that prior bond one that I mentioned before, that can often be shown by documents. So you have somebody who was married, then divorced, then remarried, and then they now want to marry somebody else. Well, you can go back and say, well, look, the dates line up here that you are still married to this person during their lifetime, therefore that marriage that you're referring to is not valid, so therefore you might be able to give them a dispensation or declaration of nullity based upon prior bond. There's a couple rare circumstances that I think I'll skip over for the moment, just in light of shortness of time. I want to leave some time for Q&A. That's the Pauline privilege, often called the Petrine privilege or the favor of the faith, and then the ratum non consummatum. Basically, just to give those real briefly, Pauline privilege is two unbaptized persons. One of them wishes to become baptized or has been baptized. The other person now has no interest in living with a baptized Christian, and so the marriage breaks up for that reason. Again, that's St. Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, outlines how that is possible for a new marriage to take the place in the interest of the faith. Favor of the faith case is very similar, except in this case you only have one of the persons as non-baptized through the duration of the marriage, and so the marriage is being dissolved for the good of a Catholic, which is either the other spouse who now wants to marry again, or perhaps a potential future spouse of the Catholic. And so you can have somebody who brings to the church that favor. It's a favor being asked for because it's not seen as something that's kind of an ordinary, it's an extraordinary request, and that's only done by the Holy Father in Rome. The Pope himself personally must grant that dissolution. We see that as connected to the power of the keys. The final one is Ratum non consummatum. This is a marriage that happened. It's presumably valid between two Catholics. For whatever reason, it was never consummated. And that has to be shown and proven because it's presumed by the church that if the newly married spouses have been left alone together, that they have consummated the marriage. So you have to, this does happen very rarely. You know, maybe something happened at the, not so much in our diocese, but maybe in other places. It's common, apparently not common, but it's more common in Italy. You know, the man and the woman get married. They have a big fight at the wedding party. They go their separate ways. He goes back to stay at mama's house, and they never form a common life. And they can that marriage can be dissolved because it was never consummated. The most common type of marriage nulli process is what we call a formal case, and I've given you kind of just an outline of the steps of that here at the on your outline. Begins with a petition. That is basically a request from the petitioner who is saying, I believe my former marriage, again, former, is invalid for some reason. And they have to give at least some sense of why they believe that to be the case. The judge who reviews it is not supposed to accept it unless he sees some hint of something that looks like it could be marriage nullity, what we call a fumus, a smoke of good laws. That's technically what they call it in Latin. If he doesn't see it, if it's basically just, you know, my husband cheated on me and I just think he's a jerk and I want out, that petition will be rejected. Now, they can resubmit it later on if they have something, you know, something more to add, but there is a minimal bar to clear for a petition. After that, the judicial vicar will appoint the judge or judges to the case, so the court will be constituted. And the respondent will be cited. So as I said, every respondent, the other party, has a right to participate. If the respondent is not cited, typically that's seen as a failure of defense of the marriage, and it's an invalid trial, invalid declaration. So the respondent doesn't have to always be involved. They don't have to choose to be involved, but they have to know what's happening to their prior marriage. After that, the grounds are set. So these are the particular things that we looked at earlier, the particular questions that the marriage is being investigated upon. And then once those have been set, both sides have had at least a say of adding what they might think should be investigated upon. Then the instruction of the case, the investigation happens. And this is done by the judge or judges. The parties have an opportunity to present further testimony. Judges might employ experts to help them with particular areas or questions. This often happens, almost always happens with cases that involve one of those psychological grounds that I mentioned. After there has been sufficient instruction, and that can take a while sometimes because if you know the church needs multiple witnesses to corroborate the claims of one or both parties, and sometimes those witnesses may not want to assist or may, you know, kind of drag their feet in doing so. That's why sometimes these processes can take a while. Maybe it's difficult for a marriage that happened a long time ago to even have witnesses that are still alive who can testify to the parties and what was happening in their relationship at the time of marriage. So that can sometimes be extenuating or something that makes the process happen longer. Once that's happened, though, once the instruction's been sufficiently done, the judge issues a decree of conclusion, that the case is concluded, and then the acts are published. This is where both parties have the right to review what was said by the other party and by the witnesses. It's very kind of strict rules around what can be how that's done. So you don't take these home. You don't get copies of these. You can't take pictures of them. This is for privacy reasons. But it is you do have a right to be able to review what was said so that you can then respond. You know, and you say this is an outright lie or this only tells part of the truth, etc. prior to the decree of conclusion, the case can come to another kind of end. Maybe the petitioner can renounce the case. Okay, you know what? I don't want this after all. Me and my former spouse have reconciled, and we actually, you know, want to continue living as spouses, etc. That happens. Maybe the case, what we call abates because of a lack of activity. Oh, look, you know, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, we don't have enough evidence here. You haven't given us any witnesses. We can't move forward with this. So the case just kind of goes inactive. After a conclusion, though, then the case moves ahead to a decision. And that's kind of, that's done regardless of what happens. There are cases, I've got a case, or had a case once where a person died after the decree of conclusion, even though that marriage no longer was, you know, active, so to speak, because one of the persons had gone to the Lord. Nonetheless, that case went on to a judgment. Final. After that, the defender of the bond then has the obligation to basically give their review of the thing. So they're supposed to be involved really kind of from the get-go as an equal party. Remember, they're the defender of the marriage. But in most dioceses' actual practice, it's usually the defender at that point becomes involved, reads through the whole case, and gives their assessment of it. And then it goes to a judgment. Again, this is either with a three-judge college in which they're to meet, and each of them prepares kind of a short summary, a votum of what they think. Then they get together, they talk about it, they hash it out. If they need to, if they're not in agreement, they vote. And whatever way the two of them decide carries the day. They vote on each of the grounds. If you have three grounds and two of them are decided in the negative, that is that there's not enough evidence to find nullity there, but one of them is decided in the affirmative, then that's the one that gets acted upon. But those discussions and the voting of the meeting is secret. And then you have the sentence. And so one of the judges would then write the sentence, which basically kind of goes through the reasons why, both in the facts and in the law too, applying the law to the facts, the particular judgment is being given for each of the grounds. After that, you have an appeal possibility. Within 15 days, either party can appeal, or the defender of the bond can appeal. So in practice, this is fairly rare, but it is the right of the defender of the bond to say, these judges made a big mistake. This is a clearly valid marriage, or clearly not invalid marriage, and he has the right, he or she has the right to appeal that decision, as do either party. If that happens, then it goes to the secondary court. Every court has a secondary court that basically operates according to the same way, although it's usually a little faster because things can, a lot of the instruction and the witnesses, et cetera, that were used in the first one can get applied to the second one. If you have two different rulings, say the first instance court said it's an affirmative judgment, that is, we found invalidity. Maybe the respondent appeals, it goes to the second instance court, they say, we didn't find invalidity, you know. Maybe then the petitioner appeals, and they says, okay, and then it goes to the Roman Rota, and then they have the final say. Also, either party can say, I appeal this case directly to the Holy Father, in which case it skips the secondary court and it goes right to Rome, and then he usually delegates it then to the Roman Rota. The challenge with that is that oftentimes their docket is very, very, very backed up, much longer even than American tribunals. Some changes were made by Pope Francis to this process in 2015, basically the removal of the so-called automatic appeal. Some changes about how the petition is handled. There's also, he instituted what's called the briefer process, which is fairly rare in practice that it gets used, because it requires that the parties be in agreement about what happened in the marriage and that they're willing to get together in the same room to basically kind of explain all that in person. And most divorced couples, at least in this diocese and this part of the country, are not interested in doing those kinds of things. Also, only certain grounds can be done for that briefer process. So a lot of them get weeded out in advance of that. Okay, so that's kind of just a real rough and ready kind of summary of marriage nullity. Hopefully it's given you some background about this. Again, you know, why do we believe all this? Why does the church kind of insist upon this? Well, because of the words of Jesus. You know, we go back to what he said in Matthew 19 and is it Luke 17 and Mark 10, I think. You know, he says that marriage after some, you know, to marry somebody who's not your spouse is to commit adultery. And while we want to have kind of concern and pastoral solicitude for people's real life situations, we also have to be faithful to what Jesus teaches. So we try to do that as best we can in this particular process. If you can't get an annulment, you know, it doesn't mean that you are somehow unable to live in the church. The church doesn't expect people to live together if they're miserable or if it's unsafe to do so. It does expect them to be faithful to the marital vows that they've made. And so it's not the divorce necessarily that is the problem from the point of view of the church and living out one's faith, especially reception of the sacraments. It's the then civil remarriage after divorce. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, that, you know, we just assume, well, you get divorced, you got to find the next person, you know, and we would say as a church, no, it's actually very possible and very, you know, very salutatorious, so to speak, that's a word, very commendable for somebody, you know, because it's very difficult for somebody to be faithful to their spouse, even though the common life with that spouse has broken down. It's possible to live out your marital vows, to be faithful to them, you know, in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, and to do it until death if the nullity can't be proven. So, again, though, there are people who are, obviously maybe some of you are divorced and then civilly remarried. That doesn't mean that you're excommunicated. You know, people sometimes think that. It used to be the case that that was an excommunicable circumstance. No longer the case. It is separation from reception of the sacraments, at least outside of exceptional circumstances. But, you know, I tell people in those conditions, look, you're still part of our parish, you're part of our community, you're carrying this particular cross that many people don't know or understand, but, you know, we're here for you, you know, and the Lord wants to help you until and unless that circumstance changes in some way. So, okay, let me stop there and kind of get a little bit of time for some questions. I've got a few questions that I can throw out there if nobody has any, but turn it over to you.
Anytime I go to someplace new, they always ask about my large vocabulary, and now I can offer Exhibit A as the kind of household that we grew up in. So just a small joke. So salutatorious, right?
I'm not sure that's actually a word, but yeah. And if you know, I'm opening the floor for questions. You don't have to necessarily, if something involves you personally in this, you can refer to, you know, a third person, you know, a friend or something. You don't have to necessarily reveal your whole life story in this context if you're not wanting to. So I think the first thing was here.
You said something about one of the cases, one of the participants having died.
Yeah.
But they carried that case on.
Yeah, because it reached at such a point in which there basically was an interest to the public good about knowing whether that marriage was a valid marriage or not. And so until that conclusion happens, the church might say, well, basically, you know, there could be more out there that we don't know, and so therefore it can come to arrest, it can abate, it, person can renounce it. But once the judge has made the decision that enough has been gathered to rule upon that particular marriage, then it becomes a question of the common good. Because we see marriage as not just something that's private between two people, but it's actually for the common good of the society to know if so-and-so is validly married or not, right? That presumption is out there that two people who get up and marry, et cetera, that they are validly married. If that's called into question, then at a certain point it becomes of interest to the common good. And the church says at that point, once it reaches that decree of conclusion stage, then basically the society, the church, has an interest in knowing the answer.
I think another concern for people that get annulments, what about their children?
Yeah.
Does that make them in, you know?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, so that's oftentimes the, you know, because if you get a civil annulment, then maybe that calls into questions of inheritance, etc. The church is only interested in, or I should say, the effects of the church's judgment in this area only refer to the spiritual status and the juridic status of the persons themselves, not anything related to children, inheritance, civil effects, etc. The church doesn't have the ability to declare, children illegitimate or something like that. So that is sometimes a concern that people have or that we run into. We would say, well, you were civilly married, quote unquote, civilly married, right, during that time. Then you presumed to, it was presumed that you were married, and therefore the children are seen as legitimate. So a declaration of nullity doesn't change the status of the children, at least in this country. Now, there are other countries where the arrangement between the church and state can sometimes be different. Italy, for example, is the case with that. If you get a declaration of nullity in Italy, then you're also civically recognized as divorced, etc. So at least in this country, though, there's kind of, the two shall not meet, so to speak. So
children are not illegitimated by...
Yeah, they're not, right. Yes.
Okay, so my husband and I was not a Catholic at the time, and we were married. I had been baptized, and they, granted dispensation for us to get married outside of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Is there ever a time where someone who is not baptized, that they will grant dispensation?
Yeah.
Okay.
For a Catholic to marry a non-baptized person? Yeah, that happens. It's rarer than a dispensation from canonical form, but it does happen.
And what's the basis of that? Like, what are they...
Basically just that, this is a Catholic who wants to marry this person, and therefore, and they've in the premarital process, in the preparation with the priest or deacon, they have reaffirmed their Catholic faith, that they will do all in their power to raise their children in the Catholic faith. The other party has also at least said that they're aware of that promise that's being made on the Catholic party. So there's certain kind of steps that are being taken that mitigate somewhat the concern that the Catholic might lose their faith.
Right.
And then it's basically just to allow the Catholic to be in a presumptively valid marriage, because we know that maybe if we say, okay, we're not going to grant you that, then they might go off and get married anyway, and then we know it's not a valid marriage. So it's for the spiritual good of the...
So I'd say, okay, so I've become Catholic since then.
Right.
Is there anything that we're supposed to do to...
No, so you got the dispensation from... then the church recognized your marriage from the beginning.
Okay.
If it had been let's say you had not been baptized and a dispensation had been given in addition for that too, dispensation from canonical form, also dispensation from what we call disparity of cult, and then later you became Catholic, then you wouldn't have to do anything different with that. But at the time that you were baptized, presumably, kind of theoretically, then your marriage would have then become sacramental. So it was valid already, but it now becomes a sacrament between you and your husband.
Okay.
And a new kind of spiritual means of grace that it didn't have before then. Yeah. Same thing for two non-Catholics who, say you have a Jewish person and a Methodist person. For example, they're married validly because the Methodist Church and the Jewish Church recognize what we call merely civil marriages. So we would recognize their marriage, but say they both decide to become Catholic. Or maybe even not Catholic. Maybe the Jewish person becomes Methodist first. Well, we would say at the time that Jewish person is baptized as a Methodist, then it becomes a sacrament between the two of them. Even if the Methodist Church doesn't recognize marriage as a sacrament, we would say that it is. It's not possible for marriage to exist between two baptized persons without being a sacrament. That's our view of it.
Okay.
And then later they become Catholic, and now they understand and agree that it's also a sacrament, right?
Okay.
So. There can be realities that are existent there that may not be aware to the people themselves. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ben, the back. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's just going from the defect of consent. One of you brought up forced fears.
Yeah.
What if it's more with the person that it was more of an internal fear, like that person himself thought, if I don't do this, I'm going to go wrong.
Right. Good question.
Versus anybody outside of them saying, no, you have to do this.
Yeah, good question. So the forced fear ground has to come from a third party. That fear has to be, and maybe it's unintentional. Maybe somebody says something, I don't even know. Well, if you don't do that, maybe you'll lose your job or something like that. It has to be, but it has to be taken by somebody else coming from outside of them. What you would be referring to, that internal sense of fear, would be more in line with that 1095-2 ground, the grave defect of discretion of judgment. That basically, because of fear that you felt, or maybe some sense of obligation that you felt arising from different circumstances within your own psychology, your process of discernment around this decision to marry short-circuited in some way, and it didn't happen in the way that it needed to happen to get married, right? So that's, it would be one of those psychological grounds.
So if, and this is a real circumstance, but if you had a child that got married, and the reason why she married outside the church was because her spouse-to-be basically told her not know, but hell no, he wouldn't get married in the Catholic Church. Is that still a valid marriage?
Oh, no, it's not valid because she's bound by canonical form to get married in the Catholic Church.
Okay, so even what, though she got married in a Christian church.
Yeah.
So basically it wasn't valid.
Not valid from the beginning, but there could be some way of maybe making it valid down the road.
Except in divorce now.
So. Well, okay. So let's say later on that man has a change of heart, or at least is, you know, saying, okay, I'm not opposed to you being married in the eyes of the, quote unquote, in the eyes of the church. That marriage could be potentially what we call sanated, in which it becomes that it's kind of recognized in a retrospective way. So this can happen sometimes too if a person is, been a Catholic, maybe he's been away from the church, has gotten married to somebody outside the church, and they want to get married, quote unquote, in the church. But the other spouse says, well, we're already married, you know, why do you want to do this again? I'm not doing this again. But the Catholic knows, well, we're not married because I didn't get married in the church and I had that obligation to do that. They can bring that question to the diocese, to the bishop, and he can grant a sanation, a healing of the marriage that recognizes it in a retrospective way and that allows the woman or the man, whoever it is, to return to the practice of the sacraments, etc. If the other person says, I'm not marrying you again, we were already married, you know. That does happen sometimes with especially Christians of particular denominations, you know.
With what I've just told you, would that be a pretty good possibility to get the
Yeah, I don't even know. She was Catholic?
She was Catholic. She decided to get married outside the church because she felt the pressure from him.
Yeah, and if they're now divorced, then she has a lack of form case. There's no, that's an open and shut, would take a couple weeks.
No, I mean, even though she's not still practicing Catholic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A couple other questions. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah.
Do you have to apply for an annulment?
Yeah, I didn't cover that. Jurisdiction. You can do it in the place where the marriage occurred, in the place where the respondent lives, in the place where most proofs are. So say, you know, maybe you got married in Illinois, but all the witnesses and everybody else still lives in Arkansas. So that can happen. Or after 2015, Pope Francis made the change, and it can happen in the place where the petitioner lives too. But it's got to be one of those. You know, you can't apply to the diocese in the United States that seems to be most amenable to granting declarations of nullity. It has to be in some way connected to either the parties or where the marriage happened. Yeah. And the first diocese that accepts the case rules out any other diocese from having jurisdiction. So if the petitioner accepts, makes it files a marriage nullity petition, and the respondent files one in a different place because he's living it somewhere else, the first diocese to accept it makes the other one incompetent to accept that.
Okay, I got another question. Would a prenup automatically be something that would null and void?
It's not automatic, but it's definitely something of great interest to the tribunal about, especially that idea of permanence. So, there are reasons that a couple could get a prenuptial agreement for that may not necessarily mean that they're reserving to themselves the right to get out of that marriage down the road, but it certainly would be something we'd want to know about. and would want to know the background of.
Well, we didn't have this talk 30 years ago.
Question over there?
Yes. So I don't have great particulars.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. Declaration nullity, yeah.
Why? I feel like it's maybe somewhat misleading as to why you don't have to have a sacramental blessing in the church after that. It goes back to the day where you are civilly married, but perhaps you weren't married by, you know, when you got married, you weren't married by a priest, of course, so you needed to have that. Is that a validation of what it's called, maybe? When you,
yeah.
Let's say you get simply married because you're waiting on your annulment. So then it's a validation of that marriage, and then it goes back to the civil marriage. So you're not required to have any sacramental, and why is that?
The circumstances are different depending on who you are or who the person is. So if it's a Catholic and they got married in the church, in quote unquote, in the church, later that common life of the marriage fell apart, and they apply for a declaration of nullity, it's granted, then the Catholic to marry again would have to be married again. Or if they had already been civilly married, they would have to have that marriage validated, or sometimes called convalidated, in the church, because they weren't married. That they're not possible for a Catholic to marry in front of a justice of the peace, right? But if you're not Catholic, or maybe you want to become Catholic and you haven't yet joined the church, but you've got a prior marriage, then you have to think of it kind of in terms of what's a good analogy here? Like think of like a house, like a Jenga house or something, right? If you've got a stack of blocks, right, and the first one is the first marriage, and it's presumed to be valid, but then it's shown to not be, well, then you pull that one out, and then the next one is presumed to be valid, right? So in the case I think you're talking about, maybe somebody was not Catholic, had been married twice, civilly.
Okay, like two Catholics have been civilly divorced.
Mm-hmm.
They get married civilly because you're waiting on an annulment, you can go through. But then when your annulment comes through, or your nullity, sorry.
Yeah.
It goes back to that civil marriage. There's no requirement.
No, they need to be married in the church. They need to be validated. That needs to be validated.
Yes, through y'all, through the tribunal, through the...
Through the parish.
Through the parish. They would go to their parish priest and say...
Is there also a declaration that the diocese can do, though, some sort of convalidation declaration?
They can do this, what they call that radical sanation.
Okay.
This is a little bit complicated question.
It's very complicated.
Yeah. Typically, the typical route is to go to the parish priest and say, you know, we were married civilly before, now we're free to marry each other. Can we go through the marriage preparation process, set a date, exchange consent in the church, etc. There are some priests and some pastors who at times in the past have done kind of end-arounded that through this what's called radical sanation. It's not that they did something necessarily wrong, but I don't think it's the preferred route. So in that case, basically, once they're free to marry, they do recognize that prior civil exchange, and they basically grant it the spiritual... From that date, they're granting it the spiritual effects and characteristics of it. But I think it does maybe deprive them a little bit of having that moment when they experience of giving themselves to each other in a spiritually recognized way. So
the church would prefer you have your marriage bliss inside the church and the parish.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
And we would say, even though, again, kind of being a stickler a little bit for language, it's not a marriage that's being blessed. You are getting married at that point in time, right? So it's a civil union that is now being validated in terms of the church, but it's this new spiritual bond that's coming about. And couples have to recognize that for that valid bond to be formed. If they just think of themselves, okay, we've got this marriage and it's been, and this happens sometimes in the Hispanic culture, we've got this marriage that already exists and now we're taking it to the church and the church is kind of giving it a blessing. That's not a new act of consent that's happening, and therefore it's not a potentially not a valid marriage that's being formed there.
Do you foresee, Father, I mean, everything we've gone over your day and having been through the process myself, it's a complicated process.
Yeah.
I understand better today, better after going through everything, the whole theology and the ideas behind it, everything of that. Most people don't. Do you foresee the diocese ever, even lay advocates can't explain this well?
Yeah.
And do you ever,
even priests. Most priests are not not able to explain this really well. Yeah.
Do you ever foresee any sort of push by the diocese to have these sorts of, you know, you can call somebody in your parish and they will come and they'll sit down with whoever's interested and they'll explain this to you and they'll answer your questions and you'll understand. Yeah, because I think there's so much confusion about this that until you talk to somebody, it's hard to grasp.
I think we'd love to do that. I think we're short on manpower. There's only about 5 priests that have a canonical degree in our diocese, and you have to have a canonical degree to serve in some of these roles, defender of the bond, judge, etc. There are some lay people who have the degree, so that's helping out a little bit. This is actually, they can have it. There's a deacon in our diocese who does, Deacon Matt Glover. But you'd have to go through canon law school, which is a basically equivalent to civil law school in terms of its length, et cetera, to get the degree. So
Steve, I think you're also talking about like coming out to like into the field.
No, but yeah, I was going to say we have done some of that. So there have been
just, like you say, the manpower,
more.
It's hard to get around to everybody, right. And I know that this is happening all over the place.
I think we'd love to. I mean, it's why I came down and gave this talk, and we would like to do that. We know this kind of thing can be helpful to people, you know, and there's more people out there to reach. I do wish we did a better job, and I'm hoping that we'll maybe get to this point, of forming the clergy so that the clergy at least can have the answers to certain things and then be able also to say, and now we've reached a level that I don't know, please call this number, right? And I get calls all the time from priests, you know, okay, walk me through this particular, you know, circumstance. So I'm hoping that we'll do better with that going forward. Some of these things have changed a little bit over the last few decades. I think canon law typically is not a phrase that even priests like to say out of their mouth, but there's more of an appreciation more for it maybe now than there was even 30 years ago, you know, and maybe other pastoral means were sometimes taken to try to kind of help people that maybe sometimes that often made things worse, you know, instead of just kind of being kind and compassionate and showing people, here's what the church teaches, how can we assist you with this? So I'm hoping that we're kind of getting better, but we do need, you know, more of that for sure. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so you said in the Jewish conception of marriage that that the view is that consent precludes marriage, not consummation. Is there?
Well, it's that marriage begins with consent. There's certainly, they would see consummation as important, but in the ancient context, at least, there was often a year gap between when the betrothal happened, which was the exchange of consent, the kiddush, and then the actual taking of the woman into the home, because oftentimes the man had to then go build the home and then could bring her into the home. So there was a gap between when they exchanged consent and when they actually started living together.
Well, yeah, my question is there a point at which that changed? Because, I mean, you see, especially like the pre-monarchical stuff, like, you know, Isaac and Rebecca didn't.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a lot of those ancient, like, patriarchal things were different, you know, in the law of Moses, I think some of that was clarified, you know, monogamy definitely kind of caught on more in the Jewish religion, the closer you got to the time of Christ, so some of that is kind of codified a little bit more, I think, yeah.
Well, also the law of Moses lists, like, legal obligations to marriage in the cases of rape and fornication, and then,
right.
Of course, in Judges, there was that episode where the tribe of Benjamin had a mass abduction.
Yes, there was that too.
Benjamin.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, was that a slow development? Or?
Yeah, I mean, some of this I would say, you know, it's not like, yeah, it's a good question. I think some of this we would say is certainly of divine law, that God said, this is the way marriage is intended to be. But we would also say that maybe God at times was permissive of certain things that were maybe difficult for people of a particular time or culture to accept. You know, same thing around like questions of slavery, you know, there's slavery in the Old Testament, slavery in the New Testament. It's not to say that slavery is a good thing or willed by God, but sometimes these theological developments took time, you know, and once it, you know, with Christ, then we would say, of course, the church has the spiritual authority to settle these questions. So, yeah, that's what I would say.
I will try to word this carefully. I'm really terrible at that. Okay, so last year, according to some sources, we had about 160,000 members of Catholic faith in the United States. This year, we're on track to be just over 200,000. A lot of these, I'm a convert myself, coming from the Protestant background. And I will tell you, in many Protestant areas, the idea that marriage is permanent is a little tongue-in-cheek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live entire families where you cannot find one single person until you get to about three generations back that has been divorced and remarried. One of the most common questions I hear at weddings I've attended is, I don't know if
you
think
I've
asked.
Yeah.
You know, so if there's no real expectation of permanence, how can the church consider that a valid bond?
Yeah, it's a really good question.
And with all these, yeah, all these conversions, this is going to become one more issue.
Absolutely. We're seeing it all the time, yeah. I mean, you might think, you know, gosh, the diocese, we do probably 300 cases a year. The large majority of those are between, at least half of those are probably between two non-Catholics, that either one of them now wants to marry a Catholic, or one or both want to become Catholic. So it's not like we have only Catholic cases. We're cases between Catholics that we're deciding. No, it's a really good question. I think we would want to know how much has that expectation been concretized in the mind of the person themselves who is contracting the marriage at the time of the marriage. So if you have this kind of theoretical, hypothetical idea, well, yes, I'm living in 2025, and I know that it's, you know, statistical possibility that I will not live with this person until death, that we might be civilly divorced someday, or that there might be certain reasons in which I might think I have to separate from this person for the good or safety of myself or my children, that doesn't raise to the level of a concrete, what we call a positive will of excluding permanence. But if you're saying, I really don't know that this is the right decision, and I am reserving to myself the idea that I can get out of this if I want to, because I think he or she has this problem, or I know I've got this problem, or we've got this problem, we just don't really get along all that great, but we're going through it for this reason, then that could be a level of what we call simulation against the good of permanence. Same thing with that error question, because it is a question of error against the quality of, concerning a quality of marriage. If someone is living in a context, maybe a certain Christian context, in which divorce and remarriage just happens all the time, and maybe in their family, everybody's been divorced and remarried multiple times, then maybe there is a possibility that that person can't conceive of marriage as even being something that might last until death. And possibly that error has formed their will to such a degree that they aren't able to marry for life. So it could be a question of thinking that this is how marriage is and being wrong about it, or it could be a question of reserving to themselves the decision under which that marriage would come to an end. So it is, I think, more of a possibility than it might have been 40 or 50 years ago that one or both of those things could come into play, especially in a non-Catholic context. In a Catholic context, I mean, I guess it's possible too, but most people who are raised Catholic know, or at least they have the idea, the error maybe would be, you know, not a possibility really realistically in a Catholic context, because you know marriage is supposed to be for life. But maybe there's that simulation possibility is still there. But yeah, I think you're right that we're seeing that more and more commonly. And simulation in general is a ground that's kind of on the rise, that's being brought up in marriage nullity cases. So there's an old statement about how, you know, the Vatican for a long time has had concerns about how many annulments are granted in the United States, because, you know, the idea is that basically marriage nullity should be exceptional, that usually people are marrying it should be considered a valid marriage is kind of a minimally possible thing for most people to do. And all the cases that, a lot of the cases that were done in the United States in the last 50 years on the, under those psychological grounds. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit uncouth to say, but there was people who said, what is it with everybody in America? They're all crazy, right? They're all got these psychological problems. But somebody else came and said, well, in Italy, it's all, everybody's lying because they're all simulation, you know? So it kind of looks at different ways of how you look at it. Any last questions? I know we've...
Yeah, real quick. So, is the Catholic Church the only one that does annulments? I mean, does, like, the Jewish religion have something that is, like, an annulment, you know? And I guess then the other thing is, if they do, is there any, like, reciprocity,
yeah.
Thank you. Between different religions as far as, you know, hey, they got an annulment at the Catholic Church, we're good to go?
No. There's nothing like this in the Jewish faith. There's nothing like this in the Orthodox faith. The Orthodox have a process by which they'll allow for a second marriage, but it's basically kind of a penitential rite that you kind of go through and say, you know, because of our own human weakness, we are not able to live apart. And so even though we recognize that this isn't a marriage in the same way a first marriage was, nonetheless, it's being kind of recognized in a lesser way in the Orthodox Church. I think there might be something similar to that in the Jewish religion. I'm not exactly sure about that, but I think divorce and remarriage is fairly common in Jewish circles, or at least in certain Jewish circles. That kind of penitential rite, I know at least exists to some degree in the Anglican Church, because I was just listening to about how King Charles and Camilla did something like that when they were married in 2005, even though Camilla had been previously married. So, but no other church that I know of outside of the Catholic Church is. Now we have the Latin Catholic Church and we have all the Eastern Catholic churches, right? So they all have slightly different judicial processes for these things. But I think we're the only ones left who are going through that in a legal way, in this way. Okay, well, thank you all for your time. And again, be sure of my availability if you'd like to talk further, or if you know, we want to reach out to me down the road. I can leave you my contact info, or you can reach out to Father Stephen. He'll give you my contact info and be glad to help you in whatever way I can. So thanks so much for your time.
Just real briefly before we conclude.